Who am I?
We'll get started. Welcome to our February Lou Jones Breakfast, and we're very pleased to have Beth Brockmeyer and Dayton Hansen. They're going to talk to us about non-consumer Chapter 7 cases. So, starting right out with what is a non-consumer Chapter 7 case and moving into some of the practical things. I hope people aren't shy about piping up and asking your questions or giving your comments about what works for you, what you have trouble with in this area. We really appreciate having it be more interactive. Next month we've got Jeff Hahn, and I'm not sure if he's going to have a buddy with him or not. I think so. On discharge violations. I saw a case just came out reported today. One of the circuits on this issue of secured creditor that won't take the collateral back, and it goes all the way up to not the Seventh Circuit but another circuit, on whether that's a violation of the discharge to refuse to take collateral back and leave the debtor stuck with some of the leftover obligations. And they said no, it is not a discharge violation. So we'll find out from Jeff Hahn next month, March 12th, what is a discharge violation? And then in April, we've got Andy Herbatch lined up, drumming up support as always for our pro se help desk. And this is really for the new lawyers or for the non-bankruptcy crowd that needs and wants to help but is a little intimidated by what would be going on at the pro se help desk. So he's going to have some real good basic tips on filling out schedules and so forth. I mean, for you old guys, come on. Maybe some refresher, some new tip that will help you out. But we're really looking for more help. We thank everybody, of course, that is participating at that pro se help desk on Thursday mornings. But we can use some fresh ideas and some new energy. It's easy to get burned out when you do that. The moratorium thing is coming, so if we could please have some more volunteers, and if you're worried about what's involved, come on in April, and April 9th, and Andy will walk you through it, and I'm sure you'll see it's no big deal. It would really help us, helps the court, it helps the trustees, it helps the system, and it helps you feel good about working for making our system better. Again, thanks again to Dayton and Beth. Take it away.
Good morning, everyone. I wanted to say thank you to Ryan for inviting Dayton and I. And I wanted to start by telling Lou Jones' story, since this seminar is in honor of Lou Jones, named after him. My first hearing ever in bankruptcy court was in front of Judge Clavert on a motion for relief from stay. And at the time, I worked for Raleigh Hansen. And basically, I got like the file and a description of what Lou looked like to go to court. So I got to court, and my adversary was Penny Gentius. And between Lou and Penny, they told me where to sit, where to stand. And actually, Penny whispered to me things to say and not to say. Don't say doomsday. I don't even think I knew what doomsday meant. But there were different things, and I thought, who are these people? Like, aren't they supposed to be, like, on the other side? So I think that's why when Ryan asked, it didn't occur to me that I could say no to this, because this is the spirit of how we do things around here, is everybody pitches in, and whenever you call somebody, they'll always take time to answer your question, whether they've got the time or not. So when we're talking about the non-consumer case, the first thing that we do is we look to the code. And the dismissal and filing requirement provisions of 707B apply only to debtors whose debts are primarily consumer debts. We then look to the case law to determine which debts are primary, or what primarily consumer means. There's two different approaches under case law. There's the In Re Stewart approach, where if more than half the dollar amount of the total debt is consumer, the debt is primarily consumer. Judge Pepper has a case called In Re Kinney, where she explains that primarily means for the most part. The minority approach is found in In Re Booth, and there, if more than half the dollar amount of the total debt is consumer and the number of consumer debts is higher than the number of non-consumer debts, then the debt is considered primarily consumer. To me, that approach could cause some strange results. You could possibly have like one large personally guaranteed business debt and maybe two tiny medical bills, but then it doesn't fit the definition in In Re Booth. The next step is to classify the individual debts as consumer or non-consumer. So you need to consider each debt individually, and I think at this point it's important to understand how your client's business worked and really how they operated and how they did things, so you don't make assumptions about what debt is for what. The consumer debt is defined in the code under Section 101(8) as a debt incurred by an individual primarily for personal, family, or household purpose. To me, the consumer debts seem a little more obvious or a little more intuitive. For example, mortgages on homesteads where the funds were used to acquire and improve the property, the debtor's vehicle loans, personal credit card debt, medical bills, personal loans. And then we come to domestic support obligations. Again, the In Re Stewart case talks about that, and their alimony that was awarded to a former spouse for support was considered not for a profit motive. Profit motive is one of the standards that is used for determining if a debt is a non-consumer debt.
I'll pitch in here. I try to avoid the profit motive dichotomy between consumer and non-consumer. I think there are a broad range of debts that are non-consumer that aren't business. Business would be an indication if there's a profit motive, then it might be a business debt. But just because it's not a business debt does not necessarily mean that it's automatically a consumer debt. So that some of the courts seem to be confused with that, but there's a whole bunch of debts that aren't business debts, that there's not profit motive, that don't fall within the consumer debt
category.
What would
be an example of that, David?
A tort or a tax debt.
Okay.
In In Re Kestell, it was found that alimony, child support, lump sum awards, attorney's fees, and share of profit from a rental property were all consumer debt because they weren't incurred with a profit motive or in connection with a business transaction. But again, as Dayton said, that's just one of the standards. Brian?
When you take the position that a debt's a non-consumer debt, how do you list it on the schedules? Do you specifically put non-consumer-tort or non-consumer-business guarantee? How do you list it on there?
Well, oftentimes it's a debt of the business, and it's a debt that's personally guaranteed. And then the contingent, unliquidated, and disputed are often checked as well.
Okay.
So it isn't always clearly identified consumer or non-consumer.
But when you're classifying the debt, that is an option. You know, you're supposed to list what it was for, if it's goods or services or if it's for medical bills. But I suppose in that category, if it's a tort, you could list car accident case.
In the alternative, non-consumer debt isn't defined by the code. Instead, non-consumer debts are distinguished really by their differences from consumer debt through case law. So we've already talked about non-consumer debt being debt with a profit motive as one of the standards. There's other examples that I've listed here. Mortgages on homestead where funds were used primarily for business, mortgages on income property, loans for business vehicles for business use, and debts that are personally guaranteed by the debtor. Another thing is income taxes. Those are usually considered to be involuntarily imposed in the course of earning income and not part of a consumption activity. And we already talked about personal injury and tort debts, and Judge Kelly has a case in Re Fungata, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that one right, where she upheld the in Marshallic standard where debts on account of motor vehicle accidents are not consumer debts. And then we come to student loans. Courts are split on whether student loans are consumer debts. There's one case where the student loan for a child's education was considered to be consumer debt, but then in In Re Rucker, the court refused a per se test to state that student loan, you know, is always a consumer debt. Obviously, this is very fact intensive, and I don't think I'd want to be the judge trying to figure out, you know, someone's student loans over a 4-year, 6-year, 8-year period, you know, where all that money went. So I was thinking about this and I thought, well, when would a student loan, what would be an example of a non-consumer debt through a student loan? And I remembered when I was in law school, there was a rumor going around that someone was using some of their student loan funds to invest in the stock market. And I thought, gosh, that kind of sounds like a profit motive. It's not, you know, used to support your family or to buy your tuition or to buy your books and pay for your tuition. Next, at number four, I've described a mixed debt. Oftentimes, there's a debt that's used for both consumer and non-consumer purposes. So, for example, if a debtor borrows $50,000 on a second mortgage on their home, they use $25,000 to pay off a personal credit card debt, and $25,000 is used to purchase hard assets of the business, then you can apportion 50% to consumer and 50% to non-consumer. So it's important to have the client identify and have them be prepared to verify, you know, that if they've done, they have one creditor that they've used for both purposes. And it's also a good idea to have them get the backup statements before you file the case, and then they get locked out in case. I've had trustees ask me to verify, you know, why I'm saying a certain case is non-consumer. So sometimes you need that backup information. And then there's debts that aren't relevant to the consumer-non-consumer analysis. Those are debts of the debtor's business that aren't personally guaranteed, like vendor debts. So, you know, usually your client comes in when a business case and they have, you know, the stack of debts that's weighing on them, but, you know, those aren't their debts a lot of times because they're not personally guaranteed. So sometimes it's hard for them to understand those don't count for this analysis.
It's hard to figure out what's been guaranteed and what hasn't been guaranteed because the debtor will rarely know.
True. Sometimes they can pick it out of their records. Sometimes they can call the creditor, who oftentimes really doesn't want to talk to them other than, you know, where's your payment? So it's hard to get that information at that point.
Okay. Now, when you file a bankruptcy and the debts are primarily tax or they're primarily tort, which would be a non-consumer debt, now you have the box at the, on the petition page and you have to select either business debt or consumer debt. There's no box for other. Which box do you check?
Business debt. But, yeah, maybe the debt is all tax debt, which,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we have forms that we're dealing with that don't, you know.
Would you rather have it be business debt if you had your druthers?
Well, if you don't want to have to do the means test,
right.
which not
right.
only
I think
is
that's important to
which
to
not
point
only
out.
Is ex- if you're dealing with a high income debtor, one you want to avoid it just to pass, and the other thing is it's expensive to have to do the means test over and over again.
So if you can make the argument that your tax debt and your tort debt is business debt, that's what you probably want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're preparing the non-consumer case, you don't have to prepare the means test, and that's because 707B applies, the dismissal provisions apply only to debtors that have primarily consumer debt. And while 707B dismissal provisions don't apply, the 707A dismissal provisions for cause do apply. And courts are really all over the place on what cause means. There's some things in the statute, like unreasonable delay, non-payment of fees, and failure to file documents. But one of the standards that's used is bad faith. Both the Third and the Sixth Circuits have used bad faith as a standard, but the Ninth and the Eighth Circuits have rejected it. I wasn't able to find any Seventh Circuit cases. You know, these cases are interesting to read. They're really, you know, as bankruptcy goes, they're kind of juicy, you know, creepy stuff people do. But it's kind of scary as a practitioner.
That's why I'm in this line. Specialty.
But as a practitioner, you know, you can't really tell, you know, where the line is drawn. It depends on the court. It's, you know, it seems a lot, you know, like one of those smell tests. One court held where they use bad faith, that the ability to repay is not in and of itself sufficient proof of bad faith. And another court was pretty strict with using bad faith. Bad faith dismissal should be confined carefully and is generally utilized only in the agrarious cases that entail concealed or misrepresented assets and or sources of income, excessive and continued expenditures, lavish lifestyle, and intention to avoid a single debt based on conduct akin to fraud, misconduct, or gross negligence. That one's pretty clear. And there's some other more technical differences when you're preparing a non-consumer case. There's that box that you check on the petition page. And I know this is controversial, whether or not you list the name of the debtor's business. It's been my practice, if it's a sole proprietor, that is listed as other names. But if it's a corporation or a limited liability company, I don't list it on the petition page under other names, as I think that creates confusion over who's filing and really who's entitled to a discharge. And then when you go to the Statement of Financial Affairs, you're looking to question 3B instead of 3A, which increases the preferential threshold from 600 to 5,850.
I get the trustees disagree with me on answering that question on the statement.
They still ask 3A when you go to the 341 hearing.
Right.
They do.
And I've been told to amend my schedules to add in all payments over $600.
I'm not following you. What are you talking about? Yeah.
On the Statement of Financial Affairs, there are two boxes. One, if the debts are primarily
consumer,
and one if they're primarily not business. Is it business? I can't remember which it is.
I think it says non-consumer.
Non-consumer. And presumably you're not supposed to fill out box A if the debts are primarily non-consumer, because the rules don't apply. You're dealing with a 5,850 preference. But some of the trustees want you to fill out box A anyway. They want all transfers over $600, despite the fact it doesn't look like it's needed by the Statement of Financial Affairs.
Yeah, I don't think I've been asked to amend, but they almost always ask the 600 question instead of the 5850, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's 3 o'clock, they're on their, you know, 71st case,
right.
you know, so mm-hmm. they're reading those questions.
Well, could the same thing happen in both cases? Like, recover a smaller preference for a consumer debt in the case of someone who has primarily business debts? They still may have consumer debts.
No.
No, that protects those preferences.
Yep.
Okay.
And then on the means test, that's the best part. If it truly is a non-consumer case, you just check that box and never look at it again. Next, when we need to consider what exemptions are available based on what kind of business we're dealing with when we have a business case. When there's a corporation or an LLC, keep in mind what you're seeking to exempt is the debtor's ownership interest in the business, not the individual assets of the business. There's long-standing law on this, but there still seems to be confusion. There's a recent case from 2012 that Judge Martin had. So there's a Seventh Circuit case, Fowler versus Shadell, that states an individual's interest in a corporation or partnership is property of the bankruptcy estate, but the assets themselves are not. The debtor may not treat corporate property like personal property for the purpose of exemptions without violating the principles of incorporation. The debtor was not permitted here to use the Wisconsin motor vehicle exemption for a Mack truck that was owned by a corporation. And that, you could tell the Seventh Circuit didn't really want to reach that result. It was taking away the guy's livelihood, but it was clear. And they cited a case from 1884. Judge Martin's case in Ray Cohen, the debtor and a limited liability company are separate legal entities. The homestead exemption may not be used where debtor does not have legal title to the real estate. Here, I think there was a building where the business operated out of and the debtor lived like in the upper or like the back part of the property, and the debtor tried to claim the homestead exemption, but it turns out that the piece of real estate was owned by the LLC and the debtor was not allowed to use the homestead exemption. When the business is an LLC or a corporation, under the federal exemptions, the only exemption that you have available for the debtor's interest is the wild card. Under the Wisconsin exemptions, you've got the $15,000 in B2. Where the debtor's business is a sole proprietorship, under federal, you have the wild card, but you also have the tools of the trade exemption. And in Wisconsin, you've got the $15,000, but it's under a different part of the Wisconsin exemption. Another asset to be aware of is if you are filing a bankruptcy for someone who has a business that's still operating, the debtor may have an individual asset in the form of like member or shareholder loans or back wages or other claims that they have against the business. That in itself is a separate asset of the debtor, and really the only exemption available for that is the wild card. Next, I made an attachment to show how I list the business on Schedule B under item 13. Dayton told me he doesn't do this. he gives this stuff to the trustee later.
What,
lawyers do things differently?
Practice of law. Practice, right?
It differs.
Judges aren't allowed to do things differently. How come the lawyers get to do things differently?
I'm shocked. Just shocked.
It depends a lot on the nature of the business. If the business owns one piece of real estate, I usually put a little blurb in there, XYZ owns the real estate that the debtor operates the business, and indicate that there's no equity in there, depending on what the values of the mortgages are. If the debtor owes, you know, 3 shares of Apple, I'm not going to list all this, the assets of Apple in the schedules. And then there are the stuff in the middle. But I usually find the more things the debtor has to put down about their business in the schedules, the more problems I have later on. So less is generally better.
Okay, well, my practice is to throw it all in there.
What would a trustee's attitude on that be, Bruce? I was asking you what a trustee would prefer to see more.
I was just commenting. You know, if you're concerned about it, should we just not disclose it? That doesn't seem like the right approach either, Dave.
Well,
I mean, as a trustee, I mean, I think you want a little bit more. You want to know what the assets and the liabilities are. I mean, the last thing that a trustee wants to do is to go out and liquidate some guy's business.
Right, but you asked for a balance sheet, and you basically have the liquidation balance sheet prepared before you file the case, because you know the trustee is going to ask for it. What does the business own? You know, depending on what trustee you have.
So you're saying you have it, you just don't put it in the schedule.
Right. So I do send the trustee the liquidation balance sheet. You're probably also going to have to send the trustee a lot of the books and records. The trustee may ask for the general ledger. The trustee may ask for the receivables list. The trustee may ask for a lot of information that I'm not necessarily going to attach to the schedules.
I work for Bruce, so I put it all in. That's how I was taught. So at 13, on Schedule B, I basically make a list of the assets and the list of the liabilities of the business. So the bank accounts, the accounts receivable, keeping in mind that those are fluctuating in value, and oftentimes they affect the timing of the filing, especially if you have a business that wants to the debtor wants to continue to operate. Real estate title to the business, treat it like any other real estate, reviewing all the real estate documents. Vehicles title to the business. This is always a great source of confusion with clients. They almost never know who owns the vehicle, or it's titled in both the business and the debtor's name. You know, it's like they never have that right. You've got to look at those titles, because it turns out a lot of times that it really is an individual asset of the debtors and not an asset of the business. Equipments and tools, we always request them to make us a list of, you know, what they have, and then to put, you know, a corresponding value on those things. Inventory, life insurance owned by the business. A lot of times the general business security creditor requires the debtor to get life insurance, like the primary shareholder, the primary member, to get life insurance on their own life. A lot of times it's term, so it doesn't matter too much, but sometimes it has a cash value to it. And then it's important to ask questions to uncover claims of the business that might also be assets. You know, is the business owed a refund or some sort of rebate? Do they have pending litigation that might result in monies to the business? And even just a simple CCAP search will result in finding judgments, you know, that you just ask the debtor, you know, did these people pay you, or is it still owed to you? Is it uncollectible?
You have the inventory of the business at cost. Is that the way you list that, or does it depend on
I think it
age?
Would depend on the age, you know. If you have a box full of dust of, you know, 30-year-old, whatever, it's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The cost today is different than the cost when it was bought 30 years ago.
So it would be fact specific, whether it's open inventory,
right.
Boxed inventory,
right.
Whether
I think
there's
it depends
a restocking
what it is.
Fee.
You know, a lot of times I say to clients, you know, if it's a plumber, I say, okay, if my husband's a plumber and he's going to buy your stuff, what is he really... You know, what is he really going to pay for what you have? It's not brand new anymore. You've used it. Parts are missing from your toolbox, you know, things like that. And going concern, I guess I'm having a hard time thinking of a trustee who really wants to operate somebody else's business and take on that liability and get bonded and all that, but it is a remote possibility.
You have to think about who else might be out there that would be willing to buy the business. Now, a lot of the businesses that we're looking at are service companies, and if the debtor stops working there, it's not really worth anything. If there's not a non-compete, the debtor, if the trustee takes over the business, is just going to open up shop somewhere else, and he's not precluded from doing that. On the other hand, if there's a former partner or other business associates, they may very well want to buy that interest in the business.
Next, I list the debts of the business, starting with priority debt, like wages and vacation pay that the debtor may owe, taxes, got to think about sales and payroll tax, and personal property tax that was incurred within the year prior to the filing, along with secured debt, again, reviewing the commercial loan documents. Cross-collateralization seems to be something clients have no idea that they subjected themselves to. Cross-collateralization clauses in mortgage documents may drag in the business debt as an additional debt on the homestead mortgage, and it becomes secured debt. So I think those debts need to be listed as liens in Schedule A and B, as well as a debt of the business on Schedule B. You know, the last client that I had that had this kind of dragnet clause, I finally decided the best way, you know, I'm trying to explain it to them and they have this look of shock in their eyes always. I decided just to read them the dragnet clause, you know, and then they kind of get like the club, you know, effect that it has, you know, that it brings everything in, rather than trying to explain it to them in a more esoteric sort of way, just, you know, this is what you signed, you agreed to.
And it's paragraph 5. Paragraph 5 on the flip side of the mortgage.
Yeah. All right, and then real estate taxes owned by the business. Review of those car loan documents, too. Again, you know, the vehicle may be titled differently than what the debtor first presented to you, and oftentimes the loan is sometimes not just in the business name. You know, it's in the debtor's name as well. Next are unsecured debts like leases of equipment and vehicles, credit cards, title to the business, vendors of the business, officer and member loans. It's important that the client can document those member loans because oftentimes the trustee will ask for that. And it's important to distinguish between capital contributions, which aren't a debt of the business, whereas a loan is. Next are debts that are incurred solely in the debtor's name for a business purpose. So a lot of times people will have a credit card debt that's just in their name, but they'll tell you that, you know, the entire debt was used to keep the business going at some point. And that's a debt of the business, but I don't think it belongs on schedule, excuse me, it's a debt of the debtor, but I don't think it belongs on Schedule B as a debt of the business. And that's another hard thing for clients to understand, too. It's important for the consumer, non-consumer analysis here, but it's not really a debt of the business. It's their debt individually. And sometimes clients were savvy enough to memorialize that as a loan from the member or shareholder, and sometimes they weren't.
And when you reference Schedule B, you're talking about where you list the business assets
at number
and
13,
income. Okay.
Right. The next, I add up the assets and liabilities, and I determine the equity in the business, if there's any, and then I apply the debtor's interest to that equity. So, you know, if there's $5,000 in equity and the debtor has a 50% interest, it's the $2,500 that I need to exempt as their interest in the business.
Do you discount that for minority share in a business or restrictions in the operating agreement or stockholder agreement on transferability?
I don't think I've had that come up.
Because most operating agreements have a provision saying that, you know, without permission of the other members, the interest is not transferable, whether voluntarily or involuntarily. And so if the trustee steps into the shoes of the debtor and owns stock in a business, he's probably subject to the restrictions that the debtor was in terms of transferring the share. So what is the value of a share that's now a non-voting share, especially if it's a minority interest in a closely held business like an LLC?
When you get to the 341 hearing, or prior to the 341 hearing, the trustee is likely going to ask you for some additional things, like corporate tax returns, balance sheets, and profit and loss. It depends on who the trustee is. And sometimes, because I've listed everything already, they don't ask me for too much. it's already all there.
Right.
It depends who I have. You know, some people ask for everything.
Depends on the trustee.
Right.
Banker's box full of stuff.
Right.
One of my recent chapter 7s. But
when you get to the hearing, the trustee, your client needs to be prepared to talk about, you know, where the business is at, especially if they've stopped operating. The trustee will want to know what happened to the assets. If there was a general business security creditor, you know, if they went back, I always ask clients for a copy of the voluntary surrender agreement. Sometimes trustees want to see that. And if there was no general business security creditor, the trustee will want to know what happened to the assets, and if they were sold, what happened to the funds. And ultimately, the trustee wants to know if there's anything left for the debtor's interest in the business. And if there is, you know, did you exempt that? And a business that's still operating, the trustee is likely to ask your client probably twice, you know, did they correctly list the accounts receivable to determine if you've got that fully exempt, and then whether or not they think they're going to be able to collect on membership or officer loans.
What time frame do you look at for the business? So you filed today, and I've got a small business that's kind of eking along, but we're just ramping it up a little bit. What are the risks that the trustee may just hold open your case to see if the asset becomes more valuable? So, if the debtor owns stock in Apple and it goes up, the trustee presumably is entitled to the value of the stock, not just the values of the date of the filing. So, business interest the same. And does anybody see anything wrong with closing down the business after you file and starting up a new one? If it's debtor's sweat equity, would that be an asset of the estate? I don't know. No?
I don't think so.
Okay. So that might not be a bad
type of business. And if there's maybe some intellectual property or a list of customers that would be useful to somebody.
Maybe. But yeah, maybe. If it's just the typical service corp type of thing where the guy can, you know, close down this shop and move next door and not take any of the assets, that would be okay?
Well, it is a Chapter 7, so it does close.
I think it's fine, but you have to remind your client that the company didn't file a bankruptcy.
Right.
Even if it did, it didn't get a discharge. And I think you have to have that whole successor liability discussion, too.
Yeah.
Well, the successor liability for the business, you know, that's always out there. That wasn't my concern in this example. It's more what the trustee may look at. You know, if the case gets held open, I don't want to be generating a lot of equity for the trustee because the debtor is working 80 hours a day.
Well, the debtor would be entitled to some compensation for that, I would think. If the debtor is working in the trustee's business.
Yeah, a lot of these are, you know, single member LLCs or something
right.
like that.
You've got a grocery store or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Debtor would be entitled to compensation for working in the business.
Even on a Schedule C disregarded entity? Based on guaranteed payments or something?
Well, if you're working in somebody else's business and it's the trustee's business, the trustee does plan to liquidate it.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that the debtor maintaining that property would be entitled to something. Something negotiable.
I like that.
Well, if I were the trustee, I would pay somebody to operate my business because I'm not going to go in there and run the grocery store.
Okay. Didn't work here.
But if you switch that to
didn't work here.
The non-exempt or not quite all exempt house, I guess there aren't any of those, but maybe they're coming back, and the debtor's living there while the trustee, when waiting for the trustee to sell it, is the debtor entitled to some sort of share of the sale proceeds more than the exemption because the debtor shoveled the snow and made sure the pipes didn't freeze? I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know, but the trustee could be entitled to rent, too.
You know, the one occasion in my life when the trustee asked my client for rent, I suggested my clients move out and let the trustee deal with it. And that's only happened once, but I suppose entitled to rent is a practical matter. The trustee has somebody there shoveling the snow and taking care of the place.
Sure.
This is really all the trustee.
So it would be an offset.
And paying the insurance. I mean, they get to pay their homeowner's insurance at a different rate because they're living there as compared to what the trustee would have to pay if the place was vacant.
There's some room for negotiation.
I guess we're on to my section of the program. Most of the high income debtors that we deal with aren't there because they were overspending their credit cards. There's usually been a bad investment somewhere that's caused them to file a bankruptcy. And so we're looking at, you know, a business somewhere where the debtor has either signed a guarantee and invested in. But if you ask a debtor to tell you who the business owns money two, they'll print out their accounts payable register and give it to you. Now, the accounts payable register will have a lot of the debts of the business, but it might not necessarily have all the debts of the business. So you have to ask the additional questions so you get all the debts. First of all, you certainly want to list anybody where there's a potential guarantee. And in these cases, by the way, if you're going to have an asset bankruptcy, these are the types of cases that might be an asset case, and you don't want to miss creditors, because if you miss creditors in an asset case, you can't fall back on the Guzman argument and try to argue their discharge. So you really want to make sure that everybody's listed. You certainly want to ask about guarantees. There will be guarantees they don't know about. I had a case many years ago where the guy had made a trip out of town for the week, and this large contract came in, and the secretary had used his signature stamp to guarantee the debt. Didn't know that he had guaranteed this large debt. Also, I ask, are there
other... At the same time, Dayton, and I say this every time this discussion comes up, listing every darn debt of the business in the individual's Chapter 7 just leads to problems. Now you send out an asset notice, and all these people say, oh, I must be owed money by this guy. I'm getting this proof of claim form, or I'm getting this notice to file a claim. And they come in and they file the claims. Mm-hmm. And then here comes the trustee saying, oh no, right, you're not owed any money by the individual, you're a business debt.
Right.
And then by the corporation.
By the corporation.
Right.
And
my concern, I understand the trustee's concern, my concern is the debtor gets the discharge and moves along, and then the debtor gets sued. And then I make a claim to my malpractice company. If I have to worry between the trustee and whether I listed all the debts, I'm always going to shift that over to the trustee, because I don't want to be sued for malpractice.
I don't know.
It's
not just the trustee that's hassled. I mean...
Oh, right, but I mean, does it... If there's an asset case and people file claims and they don't have evidence of their debt attached to their claim, then it's going to be clear that they're not owed any money, I guess.
Well,
I mean,
many times the customer really thinks they're dealing with an individual. They have no idea that this guy has a corporation or is
right,
incorporated. So they may actually have sort of a claim.
Yeah, and there's all the successor liability claims, derivative claims that are concerning if you represent the debtor, which is typically my client in these cases. You have to wonder, are there other guarantors? That's easy to forget, but there might be other guarantors of the business debt that would have contribution claims that you're going to want to list in there, warranty claims of the business, obviously the landlords. The landlords are usually the big claim, because often there's a long-term lease. You don't want to forget about that. Are there potential personal property tax issues out there? So do you have to list those? Often, you know, they won't be aware of those yet. I like to list the business as a creditor. And this is coming, this is important, actually, especially if there have been transactions that could be deemed to be income or officer loans. You want to make sure that you discharge the officer loan to the business. Otherwise, you're going to have a large tax consequence later on, if the business later treats that as subsequently income to the debtor. If the SBA, if there's an SBA loan out there, you want to list the SBA. Often there'll be claims for Department of Work, Unemployment or Workers' Comp that you're going to need to list. The debtor might not necessarily remember those, because they might not show up on the accounts payable list yet, but you're going to want to list them in case they're out there. A lot of people do business in Illinois. Illinois is being very aggressive in trying to find money these days. They're going back and they're hitting a lot of people for sales tax for doing business in Illinois. And if they're owed money, it's probably not going to be dischargeable for Illinois sales tax. But if there's going to be a distribution, it's nice if the state of Illinois gets paid. I also, you know, make sure if you've got the business debts in there, if you dispute it, check the disputed box. If it's contingent, check the contingent box. And then obviously the co-debtors, you're going to be listing the business as a co-debtor for the business debts. That'll help everybody understand a little bit what's going on with the schedules. And if there are other guarantors, they would go in the co-debtor box. And then I people seem to think that student loans are not dischargeable, so they shouldn't be listed. No, they might not be dischargeable. You should list them anywhere. I hear every day about not including a debt in a bankruptcy. I don't know where that phrase comes from. And that's besides that, and do I have any guns? Not that anybody knows about. They're my two favorite expressions.
The phrase, Dayton, is, I'm not filing bankruptcy on that.
Right.
That's the phrase.
I only want to go bankrupt on We Energies. What's the problem?
Yeah, Diona, just yesterday, do you own a house? No, the bank owns the house.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Do you own a house? Good. Tax claims, look to see, it's hard to find sometimes whether the lien has been filed, especially for the IRS, it's getting a little easier. The tax warrants for the state tend to show up on CCAP, but if there's a secured claim, then they're probably, if the taxing authorities, the IRS or the state of Wisconsin, have filed a lien, then there's probably a secured claim, and you're going to want to list that in Schedule D. The other thing that people forget about the tax claims that haven't been assessed yet, and that is not uncommon for somebody who's had a business investment, that they're going to get hit up with some taxes sooner or later. But they haven't been assessed against them personally yet, so that the debtor might not think about them. So you're going to want to make sure you list all those tax debts, even if they haven't been assessed, especially if there's a responsible person argument. Obviously, if the tax obligation is a priority claim, then you want to make sure it gets listed on Schedule E as a priority claim. And that's important, especially if you have to do the means test, because that's one of the deductions from the means test, so you don't want to miss out on those priority claims, especially those ones that debtors forget about, all the non-paid sales tax. If you've had a recent audit and assessment from the IRS, list the state of Wisconsin. As a matter of fact, you're probably going to want to advise your client that they should voluntarily file an amended return with the state of Wisconsin and generate the assessment with the state. It's going to happen sooner or later anyway, because the IRS is going to report the audit to the state. And so it's not infrequently somebody will come in, they've got this big audit from the IRS, they owe a bunch of extra money, and then you get to tell them, guess what? More news. There's more on the way. I'm worried about, well, I've had a couple of cases actually with large net operating loss carrybacks, not so much in the last year or so, but when we had the five-year look back on the net operating loss carrybacks, client who has can file amended returns going back a couple of years now and get a large tax refund. If the debtor is going to get a large tax refund, you're generally better off getting that tax refund before the bankruptcy rather than after the bankruptcy. SOFA, mostly that's a being consistent. Obviously, if you have a business listed on Schedule B, you're probably going to want to have something on the Statement of Financial Affairs referencing the business. It's funny how often the two don't match up. You often need to help the debtor remember transfers. If you ask the question, have you transferred any property in the last 2 years, they're probably just going to know. If you ask the question, did you sell or give away anything? Have you signed over a title to the car? Have you sold any boats? Have you sold a house? Those types of questions that are more specific get better answers. It's amazing how often debtors forget to list transfers. Also, if you list a transfer of a property, if the debtor sold a substantial asset like an airplane or a car or a boat, ask what happens to the proceeds, because the trustee will. And if you haven't asked the debtor that question before you get to the 341 meeting, the debtor will say, I paid debts. That'll be the first thing out of their mouth. And then they're going to say, what debts did you pay? And then you're going to learn about all the payments that were made to mother and father-in-law and everybody else. So if there are those types of payments, you at least want to know about them before you file the bankruptcy. If the debtor tells you they haven't had any income in the last 3 years because everything has been going into the business, then you ask them, how have you been making your house payments? How have you been making your car payments? How have you been making the credit card payments? And the answer will be, well, the business has been paying that. and that's going to be the answer at, and that's going to be the question at the 341 meeting, and that's going to be the answer at the 341 meeting. So ahead of the time, you're going to want to try to figure out what is that income. Is that an officer loan? Is it actually wages, or is it something else? If it's an officer loan, then you may very well want to list it as a, list the business as a creditor and list the debt in the schedules, and that may help later on when the IRS comes in and says, oh, gee, this was income, and you say, no, that was a debt that was discharged in the bankruptcy.
I think the bottom line is when you're combing through tax returns and people's documents and bank statements, if it doesn't make sense to you, if there seems to be an inconsistency, the trustee's going to see it too, you know, and you really don't want, our job is to uncover things before you get to that point so you can deal with them, you know, as best you can, or at least give the client a warning, hey, this is a preference, do you want to file now, do you want to wait? But yeah, there's lots of things you see that, you know, people don't tell you. In their mind, it's not a transfer. In their mind, they don't own. I mean, if they don't get that they own the home, can you imagine how they don't get complicated transfers and preference? That concept is beyond them a lot of times.
Right. In the high end, I don't always review the tax returns that closely. But if you have a high income debtor, you're going to want to look at the tax returns if at all possible. Unfortunately, a lot of times they're not prepared yet. And so it's difficult to get them because they haven't paid their accountant and their accountant isn't in a hurry to get the tax returns done. But there's a lot of information in the tax returns that when you go through them, if you see interest on stock, if you see bank account interest and other information and businesses that the debtor forgot they had, you have to ask about what happened to them. It's usually a non-issue, but at least you get the information, you know, translated into the schedules about sales of stock, bank accounts that were closed, and that sort of thing. I also ask about property held for another person, because I've had those cases where somebody comes to the 341 meeting and says, you know, whose boat's in your backyard? Oh, that's my brother's boat. Why isn't it listed in the Statement of Financial Affairs? So I ask now, do you have any boats or cars or trailers that somebody parks at your house? And then that often leads to additional questions, but it gets things started. Like, do you make the payments on the boat? Do you lease the boat? Who makes the payments on the car? Is car insured? And types of questions that are helpful in completing the schedules. I've had at least two occasions where somebody told me they didn't have any jewelry, and I looked on their wrist and they had Rolexes on their wrist. Debtors and Rolexes, they're the only people who I know who have Rolexes. They're people who are filing bankruptcy. And then of course you disclose it. But the big rings that people have on, you might as well ask the question so you get the exemption for the jewelry. The fourth dimension. I don't know. I just like that quote from Wikipedia. But timing with the high income debtor is probably the most important aspect of the case. And timing can make a huge difference in whether you have a consumer or non-consumer case. I had a client, he had been to several different attorneys, and they all told him that, you know, he couldn't file a Chapter 7, he had to file a Chapter 11 because his income was so high and his debts were primarily consumer debt, and that was true. But of course, once the house was foreclosed, that wasn't true anymore. So we just did a short sale on the house, couldn't wait because we had a bunch of garnishments that were pending. Sold the house a few weeks later, filed a Chapter 7, had no consumer debt at that time. At that point in time, everything was business, and it flew right through, and we didn't have to do the 11. Means test can change substantially from month to month. So a lot of these people get big chunks of money in one month, and they might not get so much the next month. So if you time your bankruptcy for the time where they just didn't get that big Christmas bonus, it's going to help you at least initially get past the means test. You might have some flack from the U.S. trustees office, but you can justify the chapter 7 rather than trying to squeeze it into an 11 if they don't qualify for a 13. Often when you start asking questions of the debtor, you'll find out that they've done some personal exemption planning. they signed over the car to their brother, or they deeded the house, or they deeded the property to grandfather. And those are things that could lead to an objection to discharge. That's a one-year look back under 727. So if you do have the deed on the farm or something that could challenge somebody's discharge, it might make sense just to wait that extra while and file the bankruptcy after the objection to discharge time has run. You still would need to disclose the information, and certainly in the statement of financial affairs up to 2 years. Trustees usually ask about 4 years worth of transfers, but at least it's not a discharge question. At that point in time, it's just a lawsuit to recover property potentially. Taxes, I mean the timing on dischargeability of taxes or the priority of taxes are pretty important. Now, if the debtor has a non-filed return, you can file the return, you can cause an assessment with the filed return. That assessment's going to be a priority because it was assessed within 240 days of the bankruptcy. At that point in time, the priority tax will be an obligation that's in the means test, whereas if it's just strictly a non-dischargeable tax obligation, it might not necessarily be a priority tax that would be a means test deduction. Tax refunds, obviously, if the debtor is going to be receiving a substantial tax refund, you may be better off waiting until after the debtor receives the refund to file the bankruptcy. So file the return, get the refund. $5,000 tax refund is not exempt if you're using the Wisconsin exemptions of $5,000 in your piggy bank at the bank, or your depository account would be exempt. So by holding off a couple of weeks till the refund comes in, you can save your client $5,000. Preferential payments. Obviously, if there have been preferences out there, the timing of your bankruptcy can be very important. I just had one where we waited 2 weeks for the last garnishment to go through because I added up the garnishments. It came up to $594. It wasn't over the $600 threshold. We waited a couple of days for the next check to hit. Then we filed the bankruptcy. Now we recover the preference and the debtor has money. On the other hand, if he's made a preferential payment to family member, I mean, just because the debtor comes in and signs the schedules wants to file a bankruptcy, I think it's the attorney's obligation to say, hey, your father's going to get sued. If you wait a week, we'll be past the one year period. The preference will be gone then. Let's look at the timing. Same rules on fraudulent transfers. 529B plans. Apparently the state bar is going to be writing an amicus brief. But the easy thing on the 529B plans is they have no contributions in the last 2 years. So if you've been a year and a half and there are substantial money in the 520B plans, and I've had some fairly large ones, you wait till the 2 years are up. 720 days for some reason, banking years, I guess. Once the 2 years are gone, it's not property of the estate under 541. Cash value of life insurance, if you can understand the state statute, I'm not sure anybody can, but if you do, there may be a two-year look back on contributions to the life insurance statute. This is an interesting thing I had just come up fairly recently. Debtor had a bunch of interests in real estate, in business and personal with cross-collateralizations. We did a bankruptcy for him, and there was one lot in particular that was titled in the debtor's name, and I had claimed it as exempt. There was no equity there. It didn't cost us anything in exemptions. Well, then I get this call, and there's an IRS audit, and the accountant is involved, and about reducing the basis in the property for the 108 discharge. You have to go back and reduce all your basis in property and reduce your net operating losses by the amount of the debt that was discharged in bankruptcy. Well, 26 U.S.C. 1017C1 says that you don't have to reduce the basis in property if it's been exempt under 522 of the Bankruptcy Code. So it didn't cost anything to exempt the real estate because there was no equity in that property, but it saved the debtor a bunch of money in taxes because he did not have to reduce the basis in the property. And the following, you know, subsequent disposition of the property did not create a big gain.
Dayton?
Yeah.
I don't know where you fit this in, but I've seen this more than once where a debtor has been paying off somebody else's debt.
Mm-hmm.
Most likely it's, you know, the Harley that was a gift to the girlfriend
mm-hmm.
who doesn't ride. But anyway, so he had been making all of the payments for her Harley.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Harley titled in girlfriend's name is another badge of fraud. But anyway, he didn't really see that as a transfer or anything.
Mm-hmm.
He had just been making the payments.
Right. How do we address that?
Yeah.
I call that equitable interest in Harley Davidson on
yes.
Schedule B.
Okay.
And then I list the payments for the equitable interest and let the trustee deal with it. But that's how I list that.
For being a member of the biker section, you're really down on the Harley.
I really am.
Thank you so much to Dave and Beth. This is great. And remember, come back next month, March 12th, for Jeff Hahn on discharge violations. Thanks again, everybody.
This was great.